House Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:18 on February 10th, 2016. With us, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Hughes, myself, Chair Olson, Representative Kito, and Representative Josephson. We do have a quorum. Please turn your phones off or put them on vibrate. And we have two items on the calendar today, and it looks like we got Ken Alpert twice, three times today. Is Ken still here? Or,
against the door.
Oh.
That Mr.
There you are. Welcome back. House Bill 248, electronic tax returns and alcohol tax. House Bill 252, electronic tax returns and vessel passenger tax. It's our intent to hear both bills today, Friday, hopefully begin public testimony on Saturday, and then wrap it up sometime next week. That's the schedule. A lot of things could happen between now and then, that's the plan at this point in time. First up is House Bill 248. We have Commissioner Chris Laddick with us. Ken Alper, how many people do you want at the table, Commissioner? Or are you going to do all the work, Ken?
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, Ken Alper, the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I was hoping to go back to the front row for this one. Commissioner Laddick and Brandon Spanos, who's the Deputy Director of the Tax Division.
Feel free to call him up.
Yes, he is the he knows the chapter and verse, the alcoholic beverage statutes, better than I do, and he's probably a better resource for the committee's needs right now. I remain at the ready if you have any specific questions for me.
Fire away. Please state your name and affiliations for the record, and thanks for joining us, and welcome back, Commissioner.
Chris Laddick, I'm the Commissioner for Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
And Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director for the Tax Division, Department of Revenue.
Fire away.
Okay.
Your show today.
So we're here to talk about the alcoholic beverage tax increase proposal, and it's an act requiring electronic submission of tax return to the report with the Department of Revenue and relates to the excise tax on alcoholic beverages, providing for an effective date. The alcohol tax began in 1933. The basic structure has been the same since 1937. It's charged and collected monthly, and the tax is on the wholesale level. Tax rate is increased with inflation and to keep up with other states throughout the years. The last major change was in 2002. It was raised to 10 cents a drink, or the equivalent of one drink, and we'll see that on the next slide, what that amounts to. It was created, it also, that 2002 legislation created the Alcohol and Drug Use Abuse Fund, which 50% of the tax goes into that fund, and it's used for mental health budget. The revenue currently is about $40 million a year, and $20 million of that goes into the drug abuse and cessation, or rather treatment and prevention fund. So one drink depends on what type of alcohol it is. One drink for, or one portion for distilled spirits is 1 ounce, and 5 ounces for wine, 12 ounces for beer. And that's 10 cents per drink is the current tax. And there is one exception, and that's for the small rate breweries. That was also created through that 2002 legislation. And small rate breweries is a term used by the federal, by the feds. They allow, I think it's, I can't remember the exact number anymore, barrels, but it's a large amount of millions of barrels that produced. If you produce under that amount, then the first 60,000 barrels is at a lower rate. The feds allow that. Alaska adopted something similar, so the first 60,000 barrels of is at a lower rate in Alaska, and these are the rates current.
Without naming anybody, how many do we have that are over 60,000 barrels?
So this doesn't apply only to Alaska breweries. It applies also to any brewery that meets that federal definition and imports into the state, and currently all the Alaska breweries qualify, and many outside out-of-state breweries meet that definition. There's very few that produce
over
the
limit.
We don't have
like one down the street that might be over 60,000 barrels?
None in Alaska, none of our producers.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yep. And it is $0.35 for that 60,000 barrel or for the reduced rate beer. Distilled spirits is at $12.80, and the proposal rate, the proposal is doubling all of the taxes, so to go to $25.60. Wine is $2.50, and we'll go to $4 if the proposal passes. Beer and cider malt is $1.07, and proposed tax increases to $2.14. There's also addition of electronic filing requirement, which we have in many of these excise bills, to help to use our resources better and save on costs. We receive a lot of paper returns that people have to data enter, and we have to image them. There's a lot of time and expense associated with that.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not hearing Mr. Spanos as well as I'd like to.
Let's speak up.
I can speak up if that helps. also, there's a change to a bonding requirement. Currently, there's a minimum bond of $25,000, and the change allows the Department of Revenue to require a smaller bond in case of a smaller producer.
Is that a bond that you take action on occasionally?
Pardon?
I've never even heard of those. Are they something that you have to take action on occasionally, the bonds?
Mr. Chair, I'd have to get back to you on that. In recent memory, I can't recall ever taking action on those. We have threatened that in the recent past, but as far as in the history, I don't know. But certainly, in order to get a license from the tax division, you need to have a bond in place.
Representative Ledoux.
What's the bond for? To protect against what? For whom?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it's for the protection protect the state's interest in case default on tax. So it would pay for tax or and or penalties interest.
Thank you.
So currently Alaska's alcohol taxes are among the highest in the country, but we do need to take into consideration that there is no state sales tax. Many of the other states that have lower tax rates on alcohol do not have a sales tax, and also there are 17 states that don't have the same taxing structure as we do. They have a state owned dispenser, or rather retail stores, that there's fees and other hidden costs there that we don't know what the tax actually is, or what the revenue to the state from those from the alcohol is. But for those that have similar tax structure, we are among the highest. For wine, we are the highest. For distilled spirits, we're the second highest behind Washington. Beer, except for those for the craft beers, we're the second behind Tennessee. And this bill would make Alaska the highest in all three of the categories.
Representative Ledoux.
Spirits, is that just hard booze?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, yes.
Thank you.
So the Department of Revenue estimates doubling the tax rate will nearly double tax collections. So as I said earlier, we're about $40 million now, so we would expect another $40 million from the tax increase. And just like today, half of that goes into the special fund for alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and prevention. We expect to see an additional $20 million go into that fund.
Representative Hughes.
My understanding is, for the proponents, the folks that are concerned about alcoholism in the state, they think that if you tax it more, less will be consumed. It sounds like you assumed that the same amount would be consumed if you're just doing a straight doubling of the revenue. So I just thought I would mention that. It typically, when you tax something, you know, the less is purchased. But maybe that it doesn't hold true. Do you happen to know when it was raised? When was it, back in 2002, if that changed consumption habits?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, our analysis didn't take that into effect, or into account, rather. I don't know that we've done an analysis of that, but talking amongst ourselves, it seems that in the past we've seen a dip initially over that first year, and that it does eventually come back up. But again, we've not done an analysis of that.
Thank you.
So we did assume a static consumption. And we do note that in a future slide that we don't account for that. Or rather, it's right here. On the slide number 8, we have estimates based on the fall 2015 revenue forecast. And this doesn't account for any stockpiling that may happen. The tax is at the wholesale level, so warehouses might be inclined to purchase more alcohol and have it in the warehouse so that it's that the less tax is paid on it.
Representative Hughes.
Is the 50% going into the treatment and prevention fund, is that a statutory designation? Is it at 50%? Because on an earlier slide, you were talking about the current tax half going into treatment and prevention. Now, this says to alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and prevention, but maybe it's all the same thing. Just wondering what the statute says about that.
Through the chair, Representative Hughes. Yes, the statute sets up, I believe, what's called a special fund that, and it does set the amount, 50%.
Okay, thank you.
So now on slide 9, the Department of this is the implementation costs. The Department of Revenue, similar to all the other proposals, would need to update the Tax and Revenue Management System, or what we refer to as TRIMS. We rolled out the alcohol tax 2 years ago in the TRIM system, and there's a revenue online component that allows taxpayers to go on and make their payments and file their tax returns electronically. And those would just need to be updated with the new tax rates, and the forms would need to change slightly. And so there's a one-time cost of $50,000 for making those changes. There's just some program that needs to go into place. There's no additional costs for this program. And that's slide 9. And as we've seen in other presentations, this is slide 10 is closing the budget gap, which basically shows where alcohol fits into the governor's plan in closing that gap, which is alcohol is actually on the next slide, on slide 11. And so there's the $40,000 of new revenue to help close the budget gap. Which brings us to slide 10, impacts of the alcohol tax proposal. Obviously, alcohol will be slightly more expensive, which, as Representative Hughes mentioned, may have a decrease in consumption. And as I mentioned earlier, there's a possible of stockpiling, but we don't see that would make a much of effect overall.
Representative Ledoux.
I guess I don't see how you can have it both ways, saying that one of the impacts of it is a decrease in consumption, and yet at the same time saying that doubling the alcohol tax is going to, doubling the tax rate is going to double the amount of revenue. Got to decide which one.
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Ledoux, my experience of being a city manager is there might be a slight decrease initially, but the rate of consumption will return to normal levels. And that's what we can't predict what that slight decrease is, but our estimates are based on our best guess.
Thank you.
I have several questions, but I'll wait till the end.
Okay.
Thank you.
Would you like me to go through the sectional analysis at this point?
Certainly.
Okay. So Section 1 adds a $25 or 1% tax penalty for failure to file electronically unless an exemption is received by the taxpayer from the Department of Revenue. Section 2 requires electronic submission of tax returns, license applications, and other documents submitted to the Department of Revenue. This changes the general tax statutes, AS 4305, or the administration section of the tax statutes, and will apply to all the tax types administered by the department. It provides for a process to request an exemption if the taxpayer does not have the technical capability to file electronically. Section 3 changes the per-gallon tax rates for the three major categories of alcoholic beverages, malt beverages, and ciders from $1.07 to $2.14. Wine and other beverages with less than 21% alcohol content from $2.50 to $5, and beverages of greater than 21% alcohol content, generally distilled spirits, from $12.80 to $25.60. Section 4 changes the per-gallon tax rate for the first 60,000 barrels sold in the state from small craft breweries to meet the federal definition of a small brewer from 35 cents to 70 cents. And Section 5 changes the statutes describing the tax filing so that taxpayer must submit rather than send their statement, and that it must be submitted electronically in a format prescribed by the department. Section 6 changes the security bond requirement from $25,000 to an amount determined by the department. Section 7 clarifies that the tax increases apply to beverages sold after the effective date. Section 8 is transitional language allowing for the regulations. Section 9, immediate effective date for the transitional regulatory language in Section 8. And Section 10 is the effective date of July 1st, 2016. For the rest of the bill, including the tax rate changes, and that was slide 14.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Spanos, the 10 cents per drink average or estimated average, what would be the I'm told that the consumer would pay more than that, particularly if one thinks of a bar, that it would not be a $6.10 drink, it might be a $6.50 drink. Do you, and that some there'd be additional costs as a consideration of the new revenue that the bar owner or the wholesaler would have to pass along. Do you have any sense of that, or whether that's accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I'm not sure that I could respond to that. That'd probably be better for industry.
Okay.
The tax increase is exactly twice as what it is, so it would be 20 cents. What they pass on, I wouldn't be able to answer.
Okay.
Wolof?
Yes, thank you. Another question. I must have missed this somewhere. The $20 million Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Fund, is that some exception to the prohibition on designated funds? Do you know?
To the chair, Representative Josephson.
How that got authorized?
It's a special fund subject to appropriation.
Okay. I understand. And my last question, if I may. In the event the legislature imposed an increase of, say, $10 million, would the administration seek the other $30 million from some other source to reach a balanced budget? Or do you have any sense of that? I know that's a big sort of...
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, it is the intent of the administration to balance the budget. Mm-hmm. And so if we take from one place, I suppose we would have to find for another, but I can't directly speak to that.
Thank you. Thanks.
Representative Kito.
Yes, thank you. So to educate me a little bit as far as the tax, at what point is the tax assessed or paid? Can you kind of walk through that process a little? So if I'm a bar owner, am I paying that tax, or is that being assessed up the chain a little ways?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, it's at the wholesale level. So if the alcohol is imported into the state, it's generally imported into a warehouse, and the warehouse owner has the license, and they're the taxpayer. And when it's sold from the warehouse to a bar, that's where the tax is paid. So the bar owner generally is it's a true excise tax, meaning the tax is hidden up the chain, and you would not normally be paying the tax. There are exceptions if you're a retail store and you're buying wine online and you're having it shipped directly to your store. You're now the taxpayer and you would have to pay the tax on that.
And then follow-up.
Follow.
So if I'm a wholesaler and I bring that material or those goods in, how do those goods demonstrate that they've been taxed?
Through the chair, Representative Kito, there's reporting requirements for all of our licensees. So in order to import alcohol into the state, you must be licensed with the Department of Revenue. as a taxpayer, and therefore the reporting requirement is it's a self-reporting, and we verify that through the through the wholesaler, and we have investigators that go out and try to determine what a retailer may be purchasing and try to match those records up. So, okay.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you. A final follow-up thing. All of these taxes, this one included, include an electronic reporting requirement. Is that something that is already being implemented to some degree, or is this going to be brand new for a lot of taxpayers?
Through the Chair, Representative Keto, currently we have our a regulation for the corporate income taxpayers that they must file electronically if they're required to for federal purposes. And the feds have started to gradually bring on more and more taxpayers based on the size of the corporation. So that is already in place, and many of our corporate filers will have to file this fiscal year electronically. And then there are many that are filing through our new revenue online system already of our alcohol taxpayers and many of our other excise taxpayers, but this would be a new requirement.
Thank you.
Representative Ledoux.
So I've got two questions. That 50% that is supposed to be designated for the treatment and prevention, is that normally go there? I mean, we just learned in a finance presentation that because it's been designated for there, it doesn't necessarily have to go there. So does it go there? Do the treatment and prevention programs get the $20 million for treatment and prevention?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, it's my understanding that it has been appropriated to that fund in the past.
Every year?
I'd have to get back to you on that, but I believe so.
New question?
Pardon me?
New question?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah, you told me you had two. Oh,
okay. So, if it's increased to $80 million, it looks like closing the budget gap will go from... Okay, just the $40 million, or that you get 20. You have $40 million per year now, so it would increase to $40 million for the general fund, and then another, or increase by $20 million for the general fund, and then increase by $20 million for the treatment and prevention fund. Is my understanding correct?
Through the Chair, Representative Ledoux, that's correct. Initially, the $40 million goes into the general fund, and from that, $20 million is appropriated to the special fund.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Actually, now I have a fourth. Is that okay, Ms.? And there's someone on different items. So the first one is a little bit in follow-up to Representative Keto's question. If an individual, instead of now if he goes to the store, it's going to be more expensive if this were to be implemented. If he or she were to order online and have it shipped in, and I don't know what the shipping would cost, and if you gave any consideration to that, whether they could beat out driving down to the corner store, and whether that would, if there's been any analysis to see if that might impact small businesses and jobs in communities.
Through the Chair, Representative Hughes, no, we've not analyzed the potential for that.
Follow up?
No, but I can expand on yours. Having shipped one case of wine in my life, I know why people don't do it, because basically you have to use FedEx or one of the air carriers, and it comes out to about $10 a bottle. For the air freight. Plus, there's times of the year when you can't do it because of the temperatures. But I don't think we're going to be putting anybody out on the street because they're going to be buying it outside, because you can't mail it legally. I guess you probably could sneak it in, but I suspect there are federal fines for using mail for that.
May I continue?
Yep.
Yeah, I was just going to say, except in the summertime, once they start delivering with drones, then and might change that. But I do find it odd that there was no analysis as far as the economic impact in regard to this revenue bill as well as others. And I was in tandem with that, wondering in the rural villages where they have struggled with alcoholism, whether this increased cost might encourage black market kind of activity. Was there any thought on that matter in the rural villages?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, of course, that's always a concern. The thought that went into the tax bills was closing the budget gap and looking at the revenue impact, and that's what we focused on. I would mention that that 50% of the revenue does go to the Drug Abuse and Prevention Fund, and we would hope that that would assist with those types of activities.
Okay, thank you. And good news, follow up. I think I only have three because I counted one that Gabrielle already asked, so that's good. And I have less heartburn actually about this than some of the other revenue bills, but I still do find it troubling because the fact that we're only focusing on how to pay for government and we're not focused on how it will affect the people of Alaska and our communities of Alaska with all the revenue bills is very concerning. And I have one more question. And that is, I've had some small craft breweries concerned, and my understanding, if I'm reading it correctly, is the first 60,000 barrels, they're getting charged right now 35 cents a gallon. That could go up to 70 cents a gallon. But once they hit the 60,000, then they're jumping all the way up to $2.14 a gallon. Is that right? And what they've explained to me, some of these are employing, you know, a few people in a community. We're having some of them in our area, and they're just, you know, they're at the place where they could grow and expand, and this will make it not possible for them to do that. So is that correct, that they would go from 70 cents a gallon, and then once they hit the 60,000 mark, they go to $2.14 a gallon?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, that is correct. If under the proposal, if a small brewer were to produce more than 60,000 barrels, any amount over that would be at the $2.14 tax. Without that provision at all of the barrels would be at $2.14. And I would have to go back and double check, but again, my understanding is that we don't have anyone producing over that currently. It may be just that it's the federal limit which makes them a small brewer, but I'll double check what those numbers are.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And if I missed this, I apologize. The increase in the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Treatment Fund, is that being offset from some other category, behavioral health, the Mental Health Trust Fund, or is this going to be an actual increase in treatment?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, I apologize, but I can't answer that. I suppose it is offsetting, but I'd have to double check.
Well, I'm going to jump in. I think I know where Representative Josephson was going on his first question, and that, at least to me, and I've got a feeling that Representative Josephson was going in the same direction as the impact is not going to be on anybody in this room. It's going to be on our constituents. It's going to be on ones that don't even know this bill is out here, let alone that the number one, they probably don't know that we have the highest tax in the nation, and then we're doubling that again. I'm not a smoker. I quit smoking a million years ago. But I always felt that the tobacco taxes were pretty much the same way, where you've gone after obviously the industry has some significant problems, but it's not illegal, the people that do smoke are the same way. And if we have the smoking bill, which we're probably going to hear next week, it's the same way. The first time most of the smokers will hear about it is when their pack has gone up another dollar or whatever it is. I haven't seen the bill yet, but and then probably about that time we're going to be in special session either in Anchorage or down here, and we'll have everybody coming in to weigh in on it when the bill's already passed, and they won't come in if it hasn't. So, but I think we're probably going to have more complaints about this bill and the extremely modest amount of money that it's going to be raising than we are off of some of the bigger ones, like the one Mr. Alpert presented to us about an hour ago. The oil companies aren't going to line up, but I think the smokers and the drinkers, after it soaks in how much we've raised the rates, I think it's going to be an interesting summer. But on that, who's next? Well, let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Culver, Representative Josephson, Representative Ledoux.
So the bond that's now going to be determined by the department. So the determination will be made for each person who applies, or will it be one regulation that says that the amounts can either be 10,000 or 50,000 or what have you, or is the idea to give you discretion with respect to every individual who's applied for a bond?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, currently we do have to analyze the tax, the estimated tax, before we will approve a bond. The floor or the minimum is 25,000. But if you have, if your expected tax payment for the year is $50,000, we would require a $100,000 bond. So it's double your estimated tax payment. What this would really do is allow us to, through statute, accept a smaller bond amount than the $25,000. So if your tax payment was expected to be $5,000, we would only require a $10,000 bond. And that would be through regulation.
But,
well, new question?
Kind of a follow-up. But it doesn't say that the upper amount is like 25 or 50 or something like that. It just gives you total discretion.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, under the current statutes, the department does have discretion to increase the amount to cover the estimated tax.
Follow-up? Well, I'm not seeing that. I mean, maybe I'm just missing something, but it looks like the language that you've taken out is of $25,000 payable to. I mean, I'm not seeing the discretion. Where are you getting the discretion?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. I believe that is in our regulations, but I'll have to get back to you with the site.
Just one more follow-up. So you're telling me that if we have a statute that says, you know, of $25,000, that by regulation you can make it 50 or 100 or 150? That's kind of perplexing to me.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I think what this addresses is doing away with that $25,000 minimum requirement, so that a small businessman, if their tax is going to be way less than that, we have the ability to charge less, or so have a lesser
discretionary
bond.
Just one more follow-up.
Certainly, followed by Representative Ledoux.
And under the current law, if you have discretion to raise it way above the $25,000, why don't you have, under current law, discretion to lower it?
Representative, or through the chair, Representative Ledoux, that's a good question, and I will look into it.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Well, my understanding is that the taxpayers are going to be the wholesalers, and so they're going to tend not to be someone that's paying a small amount but a larger amount. So I with Representative Ledoux, think it seems to appear that it's in order that it might go up. Are your wholesalers going to be how many taxpayers would you have under this? Because there aren't that many wholesalers, are there? I wouldn't think. Because we're not talking about a liquor store or a bar. We're talking about the distributor, right, who's got the warehouse.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, this would address small wineries that are producing wine and have to get a tax bond in order to sell that, as well as some specialty importers that are importing only special types of alcohol, and they're not a large warehouse. But you're correct, there's only a few large warehouses which are our main taxpayers.
Well, I think we've covered everything on 248. I think we're going to hold the bill over and then start taking invited testimony on Friday, and then open it up to the public on Saturday. And thanks again. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for 252. On the record. Geez, a couple familiar faces here to present House Bill 252, or Commissioner Laddick and Ken Alpert. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Ken Alpert, the Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue, and I'll take second chair for this one.
Chris Laddick, Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and we're here to present to you today HB 252, the Commercial Passenger Vessel Tax. And on slide 2, this is an act requiring electronic submission, which is similar to the other tax initiatives brought forward by the governor. And it also repeals the tax reduction for local levies for commercial vessels, passenger excise tax, and amending the definition of voyage, providing an effective date. Slide 3, this was created by a balloted initiative in 2006. Last major change was in 2010. And the tax was reduced from $46 to $34.50 per passenger, increased the number of ports that can receive $5 per passenger sharing, credit for municipal port fees added, and tax restricted to voyages that were in Alaskan waters for at least 72 hours. Slide 4 repeals the credit for local head taxes. And local taxes are $8 in Juneau and $7 in Ketchikan, so it's a deduction from what the state has had agreed to. Amends the definition of voyage, restoring the tax to all trips greater than 72 hours. Requires electronic filing, provides exemption for that process. Department of Revenue estimates increasing the commercial passenger vessel tax. It'll raise approximately $16.6 million a year, $14.8 million kept by the state, and $1.8 million to municipalities. An increase in the municipal share is largely due to the change in the 72-hour rule. Assumptions behind the revenue estimates, 900,000 total passengers before the tax change, 12% increase due to repeal of the 72-hour rule, $34.50 per passenger for a total of $34.5 million, and 3.5 ports per year received a $5 municipal share. Assumes number of voyages and passengers will stay roughly constant. Slide 7. This is the implementation cost, similar to the other tax initiatives you've already seen. Department of Revenue must update the tax revenue management system and the revenue online, which allows taxpayers to file a tax return online and to create the tax forms. There's a one-time implementation cost of $100,000 to recreate the tax forms and reprogram and test the tax system. No additional cost to administer the tax program. On slide 8, this is a similar slide as the other tax initiatives, showing how how the governor's budget closes the gap. And of course, you see here that the tourism tax generates, we're using $15 million. Slide 10, voyages, what are the impacts of the cruise ship tax proposal? Voyage is slightly more expensive for the passengers and or companies. sectional analysis. Section 1 adds $25 or 1% tax penalty for failure to file electronically. Section 2 requires electronic submission of tax returns, license applications, and other documents submitted by the Department of Revenue. Changes in the general tax statutes will apply to all tax types administered by the department. Provides the process to request an exemption if a taxpayer does not have the technological capability to file online. Section 3 amends the definition of voyage to mean any trip or itinerary lasting more than 72 hours. Section 4 repeals the current section of law which allows a tax reduction in amount of certain local levies. Although merely a repealer, this is the most important section of the bill. Slide number 12. Section 5, transitional language allowing for regulations. Section 6, immediate effective date for the transitional regulatory language. And Section 7 is setting up the effective date.
Representative Ledoux.
Well, this is like deja vu. I mean, I remember my first session in the legislature, and we talked about head taxes. And I remember something vaguely there. I think I'm remembering it at least. Wasn't there a question about the constitutionality of those head taxes?
Through the chair and Representative Ledoux, I believe there was in a lawsuit, and we have someone from the Department of Law. If you have legal questions you'd like to ask them, Chris Pelozzo is here.
Chair. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and thank you for joining us today.
Chris Wilson, last Department of Law.
So I guess my question was, back when, I recall some question about the constitutionality of the head taxes. So I'm just sort of wondering that at a lower rate, maybe that wasn't challenged. I don't know whether it was challenged. And maybe at a higher rate that we would be subject to challenge.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, in 2009, there was a lawsuit filed by the Alaska Cruise Association after this, after the original head tax of $46 was established. That lawsuit was dropped in 2010 as part of a settlement agreement between the state and the Cruise Association. As the settlement agreement said that the state would introduce legislation to lower the tax rate from $46 to whatever $34, and to provide this exemption for municipalities. So, if we were to change that, then the settlement agreement, I think, is still valid because the settlement agreement was for the enaction of the legislation in 2010. But I would imagine that the Cruise Association might want to revisit their original argument. So the argument was based on an obscure constitutional provision called the duty of tonnage, the tonnage clause. Without endorsing their argument was that any fee that goes to any tax collected by the state that doesn't go towards docks or other ship expenses is unconstitutional.
Apollo?
Wasn't it based upon, didn't it have anything to do with the interstate commerce clause? That's my vague recollection.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it actually was, it's not quite the Interstate Commerce Clause. That has to do with the Tonnage Clause, which is in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution. There are interstate commerce issues. It's a relatively complicated constitutional question. But I would say that the issues that they raised in 2009 would be the same whether or not that tax is the $46 or $34, I think. So,
Representative Ledoux?
So, theoretically, if we raise this tax and thus nullify the settlement agreement, if we win, we get more in the way of tax. But if we lose, I don't think it would go to back to the settlement agreement, it would go back to no tax, right?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I agree that you're correct in that if the tax is held unconstitutional, it'll be held unconstitutional completely. I can't speak to whether or not the cruise industry would want to revisit the lawsuit, and I can't speak to whether or not a court would agree with their arguments. But the potential is there that if this tax was found unconstitutional, it would nullify the entire tax.
And then can I just have one? So since we entered into a settlement agreement, is there any problem with, legally, with raising this tax now? I mean, how long was the settlement agreement supposed to be for?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, first of all, a court case like this can't affect what the legislature decides to do. But from what the settlement agreement says, the state agreed to introduce House Bill 422 in 2010, which happened. And so everything in the settlement agreement has been adhered to. There's nothing in the settlement agreement that says the state can't at some point repeal the law that it enacted. So we would not be in violation of the settlement agreement if we enacted this new bill.
One more question and then I'll stop. So would it be your opinion that since the state enacted the initial legislation that the Cruise Association would have no right to come back and challenge the law?
The Chair, Representative Ledoux, the Cruise Association dropped this lawsuit with prejudice. There are potentially ways they could start a new lawsuit, but that's what I couldn't speak for what the Cruise Association would or wouldn't do. There are procedural ways that they could potentially revisit this lawsuit.
Mr. Chairman, may I just add a comment? Ken Alper, Department of Revenue. The anxiety, if any, that if we were to lose a suit, we might have a retroactive liability, essentially, I think is somewhat limited. If you go back to the day before the settlement, the capital budgets of that era, 2007, 8, 9, 10, in that era, the state was getting, after all the municipal sharing and other provisions, round numbers, about $25 million out of the head tax. It typically had its own section of the capital budget and a defined series of projects that were dock and harbor related, very expressly related to the constitutional limitations under the tonnage clause and the expectation that we're going to use the money for that purpose. Since the enaction of the 2010 legislation, the state's piece is, frankly, about 90% less. We get about $2 million a year all in after the reduced tax and the increased municipal sharing. And that money is easily identifiable towards dock and harbor projects, although we're not keeping separate track of it to quite the extent that we were prior to 2010.
I think Representative Hughes is next. Then followed by Josephson.
Could you please go to slide 10? I would like to say shame on the administration for this, but I'm not going to say that because I don't want to use that kind of negative language because I try to be an edifying person. But I will say, doggone it, let's think about the people of Alaska and how this will impact them. I do sound like a broken record because it's a repeat of the bill we just previously heard. Because my understanding was back after the initiative, that the number of passengers did go down by 15-20%. There were fewer ships coming into our ports. And you might think that just impacted Southeast, but it actually impacted up in my area, up in the chairman's area, up in Fairbanks. It impacted the whole state, and it particularly impacted small business. So I'm disappointed that there wasn't some analysis of how this might impact our communities. And so that was more of an editorial comment, and I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I was wondering what the money collected can be used for. You talked about ports and harbors. Is that the only thing that it can be used for, or can it be some put into the general fund?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, because the suit was never resolved, we don't know if we have hard restrictions on what the potential use is. It would be our intent to use it to pay for tourism-related expenditures that might otherwise be ongoing. But it's general fund revenue. It's not a gargantuan number in the grand scheme of the budget. It's $15 million, and we could target it towards things that would meet any sort of theoretical constitutional restriction on the use of the funds.
My understanding is that there are, I believe, federal requirements, and it's pretty strict what it can be used for. And so what is being paid out of the general fund right now for those kind of things? My understanding, there's not money coming out of the general fund for being paid for those kind of things. And so now we're going to be doing things that we might not otherwise be doing. Is that correct?
Through the chair, I'm going to defer to Mr. Peloso in a minute because he might be able to give a little bit more insight into what you said as far as the federal law. In the current environment where the capital budget's greatly restricted, of course, we're not spending that much on grants to municipalities for dock and harbor projects and that sort of thing. But we certainly have in prior years. The state spends money in support of tourism marketing. The state spends money in support of Commissioner Laddick's staff that helps with tourism activities. So it depends on how you count it, but we are certainly engaged directly and indirectly in the tourism industry.
Just a follow-up remark. Well, I'm just concerned if we don't really know, you know, if this is going to help, if we can put it in the general fund and use it in a way that's really going to help close the gap. I don't think it's very well thought out, and I'd like to know more specifically about that.
Commissioner?
Chris Laddick, Commissioner of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, through the chair, Representative Hughes. I think we should look into that and find out that information, because when I was city manager in Onalaska, I got grants through the state of Alaska for our harbor there. So I know that there's a program through the DOT ports and harbors for money for harbors. So I think it might be appropriate to get that information.
Commissioner Laddick, was either 248 or 252 included in the ongoing ICER study of impact?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know, but I'll find that out as well.
No, thanks.
Mr. Chairman, yes. The original RFP for the ICER study was before the governor's fiscal package was complete, but it was tied to an earlier paper the Department of Revenue put together on fiscal and revenue options. These were all items, as were many others, contained in that. And my understanding is that was their starting point was the suite of possible revenue measures that we put together over the summer.
Do we have an estimated time on when we'll be seeing that report?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Hoffbeck said in the earlier committee that we were going to have an executive summary, I believe, next Monday. Or maybe it was an executive summary within a couple of days and a first draft by Monday. I want to go back to my own notes. But my commissioner knows the answer, and he did say it to a prior committee earlier today.
So that translates to the clip note version? Two pages or one page?
Mr. Chairman, the first draft should not be a clip note version. That should be simply an unedited or not...
Referring to the...
The executive summary, though, which we expect to see this week, will be the cliff notes, the summary of impacts. But usually for a report like this, there's a nice summary table that gets the key data that most people are looking for on one or two pieces of paper.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Yes. Can I make one comment as well, sort of an editor?
Yeah.
This afternoon, I've in two hearings, I've heard important and totally valid comments about the impact of the governor's plans on the oil industry and on the cruising industry and on citizens. And it reminds me that the university budget the cuts also caused tremendous impact. The report was there were 500 fewer employees at the university system now than a year and a half ago. And so I just wanted to sort of highlight that. I know that's a very sort of Democratic Party perspective, but anyway, I just felt compelled to say that. But to the bill, if the settlement was with prejudice, my legal mind tells me that you certainly, that is the state, certainly could not, there could not be any retroactive rescission of the settlement agreement. That's what with prejudice means. Am I right about that?
Through the chair, Representative Joseline, that's true. This lawsuit is done.
Yeah.
However, another party that was not part of this lawsuit could potentially file a similar lawsuit. The tax is still in existence, so the arguments that were made by the Cruise Ship Association in the original complaint are, again, without endorsing, as valid now as they were beforehand. So even though this lawsuit is done, a new lawsuit could potentially occur.
Okay. Two other quick questions, sure. If I may. Thank you. Through the chair.
We're ahead of schedule, so we're
okay.
In good shape.
One thing, could I was going to say either of you, but any of you, tell me all in what taxes were received by municipal and state governments prior to 2010 and after 2010?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, Ken Alper, Department of Revenue. When we were receiving the full $46 tax in 2007 through 10, approximately, the $5 per municipality was spitting out $15 to $20 million a year. So that's where I came up with the number, about $25 million to the state. It varied from year to year, and we could certainly get you a historic report. So this is a tax with a relatively short life cycle. We go back 10 years to the beginning, so it's easy for us to document. One of the changes made in the 2010 amendment increased the number of ports that could plausibly get the shared $5,
okay.
But realistically not that many cruises are going to 6-7 ports. 3 or 4 is much more typical number anyway. So I don't know that it had that much of a material impact. The number I recall from the operating budget that passed last year in the shared taxes section was $15.5 million. That was the amount that went out. Now the important material difference is that what's kept by the state, that the tax was $46. The legislative change reduced it to $34.50, and then the increase offset. The Juneau and Ketchikan taxes were in place prior to 2006. So effectively, a cruise ship coming to Alaska in 2008, say, before the 2010 reform, was paying $61, $46 to the state, and then $15 to the two separate Juneau and Ketchikan head taxes. Those remain in effect. The tax cut it to $34.50, which really becomes $19.50 because they're allowed to subtract for the Juneau and Ketchikan taxes. So now the industry went from paying $61 to paying roughly $34.50. Almost the entirety of that reduction, which is the $26.50 per passenger, came out of the state's portion of the tax.
I'd like the record to reflect we've been joined by Representative Ortiz. Welcome to Labor and Commerce. Please continue.
No, that helps me. Thank you,
Representative Ledoux.
So, how much have the municipalities? Do the municipalities receive each year through this tax?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we have an actual report we put out every year that documents it. That what community gets what amount, and it's based on $5 per passenger. That per taxable passenger that stops in that municipality. The sum total, as I recall, for the current year is $15.5 million, and it's widely disparate. That the towns that get a lot of passengers, like the Skagways and Juneau's, are getting more like $5 million. A town like, say, Whittier or Homer might get a small number of cruise passengers, is going to get a much smaller number commensurate with the number of people that actually dock there.
Ken, can you get 5 years' history and email it to Conrad, and we'll put it out to the committee and post it on our site as well?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Ledoux.
So if we take our chances that either the cruise ship industry doesn't sue again, or if it sues, that it loses, and we're wrong, it not only impacts the state, but it affects all of these communities too. Am I correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it would be impossible to say without seeing a lawsuit what the potential repercussions are, because there's a lot of different ways it could go. There's certainly a possibility that
a court could just simply state that the tax is fine as long as the state ensures that that money goes to various municipalities. So I can't say what the result would be, but there's a potential for change. So.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Hughes.
I was just wondering what, and I don't know if you'll know this, but what the head tax is that the passengers are paying as they're coming up from California or Washington or whether that wherever they're departing, and because of course then this would be added on, and just how much that will affect their fares. Do you have that information?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, I know there's lots of fees associated with the cruise industry, and I'm sure the industry will be before the committee. There's docking fees and head taxes in different locations. To the extent those are built into the cost structure of a room or added on as a surtax at the end of an invoice, I couldn't tell you, honestly. I don't know what the taxes are charged by jurisdictions outside of Alaska might be.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Any questions on the fiscal note? It was pretty self-explanatory. With that, we're going to hold this bill over until Friday, too, and we'll start hearing from the people in the back row. And with that, we will adjourn at 4:20.